American Free Press Audio Issue Number 43 and 44, October 21 and 28, 2019. Fake news: CNN busted again. Whistleblower reveals anti-Trump infatuation. CNN president caught on tape inventing news, by John Friend. Project Veritas, the nonprofit organization founded by investigative journalist James O'Keefe that is dedicated to exposing corruption, has once again exposed the blatant anti-Trump, left-wing political bias of yet another powerful player in American society. CNN, one of the most influential and establishment-serving media outlets in the nation, in a recently released bombshell video, O'Keefe interviews Carrie Porch, a CNN insider who approached Project Veritas in an effort to expose the media giant's political bias and anti-Trump agenda. Porch worked as a satellite uplink technician and contractor at CNN's Washington, D.C. bureau and agreed to wear a hidden camera to expose the bias running rampant at CNN. Project Veritas has a history of using whistleblowers and insiders to expose corruption and bias at powerful organizations and institutions operating in society, such as Google, as this newspaper has reported in previous editions. The latest video released by Project Veritas includes clips of a conference call hosted by current CNN president Jeffrey Zucker, who has a personal vendetta against Trump, according to one CNN employee recorded by Porch. The video also features clips of various CNN employees, all of whom express frustration with the network's anti-Trump bias and obsessive fixation on the president. Impeachment is the story, Zucker emphatically stated during a recent morning conference call with CNN senior management and executives. These calls largely set the agenda and focus of the network. You know, I know we're going to feel our tendency to think we're doing too much, but this is the story, Zucker would go on to emphasize that he wanted CNN's top reporters and political analysts to focus primarily on the impeachment proceedings being maliciously pursued against President Donald Trump by leading Democrats, and that other stories and news developments should be put on the back burner. Don't lose sight of what the biggest story is, Zucker stated. CNN's agenda mirrors other left-leaning media and activist organizations, which have long worked to demonize and smear the president in an effort to stymie his political ambitions. There's just nothing we can do if Zucker wants impeachment every single day to be the top story, Christian Sierra, a media coordinator at CNN, stated in an undercover recording by Porch and released by Project Veritas. Everyone at the network complains about it. They hate covering Trump every day. In another conference call led by Zucker, who previously worked with Trump on the reality show The Apprentice, attacked Fox News and the GOP, arguing that what's going on in America now is really fundamentally the result of years of fake news, conspiracy nonsense from Fox News that has taken root in this country. The latest revelations should come as no surprise to readers of this newspaper, which has documented the blatant anti-Trump left wing political bias prevailing at most mainstream establishment media outlets. Trump himself has regularly attacked what he calls the fake news media, including CNN and the New York Times, which have proven time and again how hostile they are toward the president and his America First agenda. The president recently described CNN as a virtual fraud on Twitter and insinuated that Zucker would be resigning at any moment given the scandalous information released by Project Veritas. In the video, Porch elaborated on his decision to partner with Project Veritas and O'Keefe to expose CNN's anti-Trump agenda. "I was about to quit, and I wrestled with the decision long and hard," Porch explained to O'Keefe in the video interview released by Project Veritas. "I mean, you, O'Keefe, and I spoke for weeks before we kind of decided to do this. This is exposing most likely the biggest media conglomerate in the world. I lose sleep over it." Porch continued to explain his rationale and motivation for blowing the whistle on CNN. "I decided to wear the camera because I didn't see any other option, because I noticed that I was in a unique position in space and time to just do something to protect the Republic, to basically put everything in the sunshine that I could, let the cards fall where they may, and hopefully to let us have at least one more free and fair election." Project Veritas has vowed to release more undercover recordings and other information demonstrating CNN's hyper-partisan, anti-Trump agenda. which proves once again how completely dishonest and biased the mainstream mass media is in this country. To his credit, Trump has fought back and worked to expose this blatant political bias, accurately describing the fake news media as the enemy of the people on multiple occasions. As the 2020 election approaches, expect more of the same highly partisan, anti-Trump rhetoric and fake news to be disseminated on a daily basis from the increasingly discredited mainstream mass media establishment. We told you so. The media is the enemy. On October 14th, media watchdog Project Veritas dropped a series of blockbuster videos that were secretly recorded by a whistleblower working for CNN's Washington, D.C. bureau. AFP writer John Friend provides the details on this incredible story for our front page this week, demonstrating what we've been saying for years: the controlled mainstream media is the enemy of the American people. So why did this whistleblower, Kerry Porch, risk his career to come clean about what he has been witnessing behind the scenes at the country's biggest cable news outlet? Fed up with the way things have been going, Porch said, "I decided to wear a hidden camera to expose the bias." For those who haven't seen it, the videos were gifts to conservatives, proving that, yes, indeed, the self-proclaimed most trusted name in news is totally biased and 100% fake. And the sad thing is, as the video makes evident, many who work there clearly know this to be true, but, for them, ratings and paychecks are more important than any concern over deceitfully manipulating the masses. In other words, contrary to all the claims, these people are not unbiased, objective, impartial journalists but are agenda-driven, partisan activists, who are told what to think by the guy who signs their paychecks. Porch said he wore a hidden camera for months, documenting conversations and conference calls with many of the cable TV network's top executives, including CNN President Jeff Zucker, who appears to be the ringleader in this circus sideshow. Here are some of the most absurd things that Zucker can be overheard saying in the whistleblower videos. In total willful denial of his own bias, Zucker told top executives in one call, "I think what's going on in America now is really fundamentally the result of years of fake news, conspiracy nonsense from Fox News that has taken root in this country." This is ironic, considering that Zucker once got a paycheck from Fox for working for none other than our current president, Donald Trump. It's worth emphasizing here that CNN was a leading promoter of the now totally debunked Russiagate story, but rather than be embarrassed, admit to the mistake, and make amends, Zucker is clearly doubling down by ordering his staff to push the latest farcical tale about Ukraine and the president. "I want to stay with this, our top, our own reporters, our own political analysts, the top, unintelligible, we have." Zucker can be heard telling staff in one of the videos released by Project Veritas, "Okay, so make sure we're doing that. All these moves are moves towards impeachment. So, don't lose sight of what the biggest story is." Clearly, from his statements, Zucker is not interested in the slightest about providing fair and balanced reporting. In fact, he's not even making the pretense of encouraging his staff to go where the story takes them. Instead, he is focused solely on taking down President Donald Trump, whether the story is even true or not, just as the president has been saying over and over. In contrast, the editors at American Free Press give our writers free rein to go where the information takes them. If they had information that the president of the United States was corrupt and violated the Constitution, we would have no problem publishing it. On the other hand, because we are not partisan hacks, when our writers find reports that contradict the popular narrative, we believe it's vital to publish that information no matter who might be upset by it. As of now, it looks like there will be no immediate repercussions for the executives at CNN, other than the fact that the fake news network's ratings continue to decline. Whatever may happen, Americans cannot deny the truth. The biggest news outlets in this country are not impartial when it comes to perhaps the most important job in this country: delivering honest, candid, objective information to Americans so they can make informed decisions about electing their representatives to send to the nation's capital. It's obvious that they truly are the enemy of the American people. Christopher J. Petherick, executive editor, shady cybersecurity outfit cooked up Russiagate hoax. by St. Patrick until President Donald Trump introduced the name CrowdStrike into the feisty political discussion of the day. Americans would have been forgiven had they thought it was another bad policy from an overbearing police state. It is not. CrowdStrike is a cybersecurity firm that specializes in protecting large corporations such as Goldman Sachs and Amazon Web Services. It also investigates high-level hacks on large institutions. The Democratic National Committee, DNC, hired CrowdStrike to trace the source of the 2016 hacks of DNC computers. CrowdStrike then became the first voice to push what was the basis of the RussiaGate hoax, that Russian hackers, at the behest of the Russian government, broke into DNC computers and then leaked the contents to the American media in order to guarantee the election of Trump over Hillary Clinton. In the July 25 call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Trump referenced CrowdStrike. "I would like to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike," Trump said. "I guess you have one of your wealthy people. The server, they say Ukraine has it." Trump believes RussiaGate began with CrowdStrike and Ukraine's willingness to blame Russia for what the DNC believed were the reasons for its loss. Ukraine has been in a hot and cold war with Russia since 2014. The argument Trump was making was that there was either a computer server located in the Ukraine or that the contents of the DNC computers were being stored in the Ukraine. Why wouldn't former Hillary Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta and Hillary Clinton allow the FBI to see the server? Trump asked in an Associated Press interview in April 2017. "They brought in another company that I hear is Ukrainian-based." Trump went on to tell the interviewer that he had heard that CrowdStrike was owned by a very rich Ukrainian, which it is not. CrowdStrike's Dmitry Alperovich is a Russian-born U.S. citizen who came to America as a child and graduated from the University of Georgia. He is not Ukrainian, and he is not one of Zelensky's wealthy people. CrowdStrike is based in California. It is not uncommon for Trump to mishandle details and make wild assumptions. Being a quick thinker with a reflexive personality causes him to blurt out answers, which he then wants investigated, rather than waiting to form answers after an investigation has been completed. However, as per usual, there is a kernel of truth in some of Trump's most impulsive suspicions. Perkins Coie was the law firm that represented Clinton and the DNC during the 2016 campaign. It was Perkins Coie that aided in recruiting CrowdStrike to investigate the hacks into DNC computers. It was also Perkins Coie who paid Fusion GPS to enlist British spy Christopher Steele in the drafting of the now discredited Steele dossier. Perkins Coie, then, knew the angles that the DNC wanted followed, a mythology that would lead to the Russian interference narrative. They knew this when they recruited Steele, and they knew this when they hired CrowdStrike. Alperovich, CrowdStrike's co-founder and chief technology officer, CTO, is an on-resident senior fellow of the Cyber Statecraft Initiative at the Atlantic Council. The Atlantic Council's view of Russia has been described as hawkish. The Atlantic Council is funded by Google Incorporated, George Soros's Open Society Foundations, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund Incorporated, and the State Department. Funding for the Atlantic Council also comes from Burisma, the natural gas company that paid Joe Biden's son, Hunter, $50,000 a month to serve on its board. After the hacks into the DNC computers had been made public, the FBI pushed to gain direct access to them in order to conduct a thorough forensic examination. The DNC, incredibly, refused direct access to the FBI and instead struck a deal that would allow a third party, CrowdStrike, to conduct the investigation and gather the information, which it would share with the FBI. James Comey, then FBI director, agreed to this deal rather than pushing for direct access. This poorly mitigated agreement allowed all information gained by the FBI, and thus the Robert Mueller investigative team, to first flow through CrowdStrike and Alperovich, who was linked to an anti-Russian think tank with deep state funding. From CrowdStrike, the FBI received only preliminary reports. There was no final report written, according to documents released in submitted motions from the ongoing Roger Stone case. In Senate Intelligence Committee hearings, Comey also confirmed that he had received no actual server content from CrowdStrike. Only preliminary reports from the organization that he called a high-class entity, the CrowdStrike saga reveals the origin of Russia quite clearly. The DNC was hacked. They hired an anti-Russian company founded by a fellow at an anti-Russian think tank to say, Russia did it, rather than allowing the FBI, America's ranking law enforcement agency, to investigate a hack that supposedly turned the country's greatest democratic process upside down. The DNC bucked the FBI in favor of Al Perovich, whom Comey approved. Obama okayed spying on T-Rump. Officials on Donald Trump's presidential campaign were illegally surveilled by Donald Jeffries. Multiple senior Trump administration officials recently told Fox News that U.S. Attorney John Durham is conducting a wider inquiry into possible misconduct on the part of the Obama administration toward the 2016 Trump presidential campaign than was previously known. Durham was appointed by Barr in May of this year to look into alleged improper surveillance of the Trump presidential campaign by Obama administration officials. Durham is now said to be exploring the crucial period between just prior to the 2016 election and the inauguration of Donald Trump. The expansion of his investigation is based upon what he has already discovered, and extends to the spring of 2017, when Robert Mueller was named special counsel. Durham is gathering information from numerous sources, including a number of foreign countries. At Attorney General Barr's request, the president has contacted other countries to ask them to introduce the Attorney General and M.R. Durham to appropriate officials, Justice Department spokeswoman Carrie Kupik stated. Durham and Barr have traveled to Italy and spoken to officials in both Australia and the United Kingdom during the course of their investigation. Durham is said to be concentrating on how FBI informants may have been used in the alleged improper issuance of Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, warrants in order to ensure that intelligence collection activities by the U.S. government related to the Trump 2016 presidential campaign were lawful and appropriate. Rep. Nancy Pelosi, DeKalb, and other leading Democrats have responded by attacking Barr, accusing him of having gone rogue. I think what they are going is the cover-up of the cover-up, and that's really very sad for them, to have a Justice Department go so rogue. They have been for a while, and now it just makes matters worse, Pelosi stated on MSNBC's Morning Joe program. Former U.S. Attorney Joe DiGenova told Lou Dobbs of Fox Business News back in August that Durham's investigation was moving at lightning speed. DiGenova responded yes to Dobbs's question, is there any reason for me? For everyone watching, for everyone listening to you to think that we're actually going to see the scoundrels who made up the leadership of the Department of Justice and the FBI be held accountable? DiGenova continued, in a very short period of time John Durham has interviewed, I understand, dozens of potential witnesses and has moved into setting up a grand jury, so it's going to happen. But, eventually, Durham is focused on a very large criminal conspiracy involving defrauding the United States government of faithful service of these agencies. It isn't going to happen quickly, and there are going to be some instances where he isn't going to have enough evidence to charge even some pretty big people initially, but some of these players will be involved in more than one series of criminal investigations. So if they get a pass in one instance, they may not get it in another. It has also been reported that Durham's investigation reached out to Maltese academic Joseph Mifsud, who famously told former Trump campaign adviser George Papadopoulos that the Russians had damaging information about Hillary Clinton, in the form of thousands of emails. Papadopoulos then passed this claim on to Australian diplomat Alexander Downer in a London bar on May 10, 2016. Link University, where Mifsud met Papadopoulos, is closely connected to British intelligence. The FBI also held a training program there, a fact conveniently omitted from Mueller's report. In July, investigative reporter John Solomon, citing multiple credible sources and contemporaneous emails, claimed that Durham's team had been in contact with Mifsud's Swiss attorney, Stefan Rowe. According to Solomon, they are hoping to interview Mifsud or at the very least review a recorded deposition the professor gave in summer 2018 about his role in the drama involving Donald Trump, Russia, and the 2016 election, Solomon wrote. The report claims Mifsud planted the story about the Clinton emails in Moscow and then lied about his dealings with Papadopoulos when interviewed by the FBI in 2017. Papadopoulos has pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with Mifsud. Solomon also noted that, unlike others accused of misleading Mueller, including Papadopoulos, former Trump advisor Michael Flynn, and former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort, Mifsud was not charged with a crime. Roe told Solomon that Mifsud was a longtime cooperator of Western Intel who was asked by intelligence-connected contacts at Link University to meet with Papadopoulos. Among those world leaders who Mifsud and other Link officials met regularly with was Britain's new Prime Minister Boris Johnson. To our mainstream media, all this is less newsworthy than Trump's peripheral interest in the corruption of Joan Hunter Biden. Fake news MSM does CIA's bidding. Major publisher admits U.S. government approves what stories go into its rag. By St. Patrick, the First Amendment to the Constitution guarantees freedom of the press. The Bill of Rights was added when state rights advocates and populists worried freedoms would need protecting from an ever-expanding federal government. That freedom would eventually need protecting from the press itself seemed unthinkable. Yet, as the New York Times has shown, the mainstream media keeps burying the last remaining vestiges of its greatest protection with its own shovel. After running a June 15 story about recent American innovations in cyber warfare and the way they are applied against Russia's power grid, President Donald Trump charged that, by printing the story, the New York Times had committed treason. In direct response, the Times confirmed to the president that it had run the story by U.S. officials before printing it. Accusing the press of treason is dangerous, the Times responded on Twitter. We described the article to the government before publication. As our story notes, President Trump's own national security officials said there were no concerns. The predominant spin put on the story by the MSM conglomerates was the typical furtherance of the Trump versus the press narrative. But, as Ben Norton wrote at news website Consortium News, the media completely missed the point of the Times's accidentally transparent response. But what was entirely overlooked was the most revealing thing in the New York Times's statement. The newspaper of record was essentially admitting that it has a symbiotic relationship with the government, Norton wrote. As Norton points out, one of the great enemies of press freedom is Washington Post columnist Mark Thiessen, a neoconservative who served as a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Thiessen notably called WikiLeaks's Julian Assange a spy who deserves prison. He emphasized that Assange is not a journalist. Thiessen's reasoning regarding Assange's lack of journalistic credentials was even more troubling. Thiessen wrote that unlike reputable news organizations, Assange did not give the U.S. government an opportunity to review the classified information WikiLeaks was planning to release so they could raise national security objections. So responsible journalists have nothing to fear. The truth, however, is that responsible journalists have had much to fear since reporter Carl Bernstein, the co-author of All the President's Men, first wrote in a 1977 Rolling Stone magazine article that the mainstream media had been thoroughly infiltrated and corrupted by the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, using documents on file at the CIA. Bernstein referenced more than 400 American journalists who in the past 25 years have secretly carried out assignments for the Central Intelligence Agency. Bernstein traced the influence as far back as 1953 when syndicated columnist Joseph Alsop was sent to the Philippines to cover a national election. Alsop was not asked to cover the story on site by the newspapers that ran his column. He was asked to go by the CIA. There were organizations more influenced by the CIA than others. By far the most valuable of these associations, according to CIA officials, have been with the New York Times, CBS, and Time Incorporated, Bernstein wrote. While the article is still seen as a giant leap forward in the practice of watching the watchman, Bernstein can rightly be criticized for not once mentioning his former employer, The Washington Post, and his former partner, Bob Woodward. In the article, both have long been tied to the high-level influences of the CIA, the U.S. Department of Defense, and the FBI. The CIA influence stems from Operation Mockingbird, a 1950s program initiated by the CIA to infiltrate, influence, and sway powerful media organizations to run propaganda advantageous to the CIA and the financiers that fund its covert operations. The most obvious reasons for the most recent acquiescence to official government sources are grounded in relationships. The journalistic corps is becoming younger and less experienced. In the competitive, dying industry that is mainstream print journalism, reporters feel they need to sow the seeds of partnership in order to get those calls that turn into the cultivation of high-level sources who feed them exclusive stories. Presidents from LBJ to Nixon to George W. Bush to Obama to Trump have used the power of access to bar unfriendly press outlets from press conferences and events. Thiessen was wrong in describing the relationship as a responsibility of a good journalist or a real journalist, but the pressure to maintain access is real. It is difficult to believe that Ben Franklin would have run a story past Massachusetts Governor Thomas Hutchison before printing it. Ida Tarbell surely didn't run her expose on Standard Oil past John D. Rockefeller before printing it in McClure's magazine. They understood that for freedom of the press to truly exist, reporters and editors need to exercise those very freedoms with which they have been endowed. Kurds ally with Syria, by Dr. Ron Paul. When President Donald Trump tweeted earlier in October that it is time for us to get out of these ridiculous endless wars, adding that the U.S. would be withdrawing from Syria, Washington went into a panic. Suddenly Republicans, Democrats, the media, the think tanks, and the war industry all discovered and quickly became experts on the Kurds, who we were told were an ally being sent to their slaughter by an ignorant president. But it was all just another bipartisan ploy to keep the forever war gravy train rolling through the Beltway. Interventionists will do anything to prevent U.S. troops from ever coming home, and their favorite tactic is promoting mission creep. As Trump tweeted, we were told in 2014 by President Barack Obama that the U.S. military would go into Syria for just 30 days to save the Yazidi minority that they claimed were threatened. Then that mission crept into we must fight ISIS, and so the U.S. military continued to illegally occupy and bomb Syria for 5 more years, even though it was the Syrian army with its Russian and Iranian allies that did the bulk of the fighting against al-Qaeda and ISIS in Syria. Trump took credit and called for the troops to come home. But when the military comes home, the military-industrial congressional media complex loses its cash cow, so a new rationale had to be invented. The latest mission creep was that we had to stay in Syria to save our allies, the Kurds. All of a sudden our military presence in Syria was not about fighting terrorism but rather about putting U.S. troops between our NATO ally Turkey and our proxy fighting force, the Kurds. Do they really want us to believe that it is pro-American for our troops to fight and die refereeing a long-standing dispute between the Turks and Kurds? It was a colossally dumb idea to train and arm the Kurds in Syria in the first place. But after spending billions backing what turned out to be al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria to overthrow the Assad government, Washington found that the Kurds were the only willing boots remaining on the ground. While their interest in fighting ISIS was limited, they were happy to use Washington's muscle in pursuit of their long-term goal of carving out a part of Syria, and eventually Turkey, for themselves. We can never leave because there will be a slaughter, Washington claimed, and the media faithfully repeated. But once again, the politicians, the mainstream media, and the Beltway experts have been proven wrong. They never understand that sending U.S. troops into another country without the proper authority is not a stabilizing factor, but a destabilizing factor. I have argued that were the U.S. to leave Syria, and the rest of the Middle East, the countries of the region would find a way to solve their own problems. Now that the U.S. is pulling back from northern Syria, that is just what is happening. On Sunday, the Kurds and the Syrian government signed an agreement, brokered by the Russians, to put aside their differences and join together to defend against Turkey's incursion into Syrian territory. Now our Kurdish allies are fighting alongside the army of Syrian President Assad, who we are still told by U.S. officials must go. Washington doesn't understand that our intervention only makes matters worse. The best way to help the Kurds and everyone else in the region is to just come home. Is President finally ending the era of interventionism? By Patrick J. Buchanan. President Donald Trump could have been more deft and diplomatic in how he engineered that immediate pullout from northeastern Syria. Yet that withdrawal was as inevitable as were its consequences. 1,000 U.S. troops and their Kurdish allies were not going to dominate indefinitely the entire northeast quadrant of a country the size of Syria against the will of Damascus and its army. Had the U.S. refused to vacate Syrian lands on Turkey's demand, a fight would be inevitable, whether with Turkey, Damascus, or both, and this nation would neither support nor sustain a new war with Turks or Syrians. And whenever the Americans did leave, the Kurds, facing a far more powerful Turkey, were going to have to negotiate the best deal they could with Syria's Bashar Assad. Nor was President Recep Erdogan of Turkey going to allow Syrian Kurds to roost indefinitely just across his southern border, cheek by jowl with the Turkish Kurds of the PKK that Erdogan regards as a terrorist threat to the unity and survival of his country. It was Russia that stepped in to broker the deal whereby the Kurds stood down and let the Syrian army take over their positions and defend Syria's border regions against the Turks. Some ISIS prisoners under Kurdish control have escaped, but if the Syrian army takes custody of these prisoners from their Kurdish guards, those ISIS fighters and their families will suffer fates that these terrorists have invited. Denunciation of Erdogan for invading Syria is almost universal. Congress is clamoring for sanctions. NATO allies are cutting off weapons sales. But before we act, we need some history. Turkey has been a NATO ally, a treaty ally, for almost 7 decades. The Kurds are not. Turkish troops fought alongside us in Korea. Turkey hosted Jupiter missiles targeted on the USSR in the Cold War. Nuclear missiles we withdrew as our concession in the secret JFK-Khrushchev deal that ended the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Turks accepted the U.S. weapons, and then accepted their removal. The Turks have the second largest army in NATO. They are a nation of 80 million, a bridge between Europe and the Middle East. They dominate the Dardanelles and the Bosphorus, the entrance to an exit from the Black Sea for all U.S. and Russian warships. U.S. warplanes are based at Turkey's Incirlik Air Base, as are 50 U.S. nuclear weapons, and Turkey harbors millions of refugees from the Syrian civil war, whom Erdogan keeps from crossing into Europe. Moreover, Erdogan's concern over the Syrian Kurdish combat veterans on his border should be understood by us. When Pancho Villa launched his murderous 1916 raid into Columbus, NM, we sent General Black Jack Pershing with an army deep into Mexico to run him down. With no allies left fighting on our side in Syria, the small U.S. military force there is likely to be withdrawn swiftly and fully. Today, the Middle East and world have been awakened to the reality that when Trump said he was ending everlasting commitments and bringing U.S. troops home from endless wars, he was not bluffing. The Saudis got the message when the U.S., in response to a missile and drone strike from Iran or Iranian-backed militias, which shut down half of Riyadh's oil production, did nothing, said Washington. This is between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Hence, it was stunning that the administration, at the end of last week, under fire from both parties in the House and Senate for abandoning the Kurds, announced the deployment of 1,500 to 3,000 troops to Saudi Arabia to bolster the kingdom's defense against missile attacks. The only explanation for the contradiction is Senator Henry Ashurst's maxim: the clammy hand of consistency should never rest for long upon the shoulder of a statesman. Yet, this latest U.S. deployment notwithstanding, Saudi Arabia has got the message. Trump will sell them all the weapons they can buy, but no Saudi purchase ensures that the Yanks will be coming to fight their wars. Thus, the Saudis have begun negotiating with the Houthi rebels, with whom they have been at war in Yemen since 2015, and they are seeking talks with Iran. A diplomatic resolution of quarrels seems to have come to commend itself to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, once he learned that the Americans do not regard Saudi Arabia as weak NATO allies, and Israel. Undeniably, the decisions not to retaliate against Iran for the attack on Riyadh's oil facilities and the decision to terminate abruptly the alliance with Syria's Kurds sent shockwaves to the world. Where the Americans spent much of the Cold War ruminating about an agonizing reappraisal of commitments to malingering allies, this time the Yanks may be deadly serious. This time, the Americans may really be going home. Every nation that today believes it has an implied or a treaty guarantee that the U.S. will fight on its behalf should probably recheck its whole card. Few winners, Many losers in chaotic Syrian situation, by Richard Walker. It is an incontrovertible fact that President Donald Trump made an election promise to end America's role in foreign wars, and that he has been following through on that objective. It is equally true that there are no easy ways of achieving his goal, and mistakes are inevitable. His critics range from neocons in both parties in Congress to our NATO allies, and the Kurds whom he has abandoned to an uncertain fate at the hands of the Turkish military. All those who have strong opinions about the developing crisis in Syria have reason to believe their cause is right, but the truth is that there are no hard and fast rules for pulling U.S. forces out of Middle East hotspots, and none of those arguing for or against severing ties to the Kurds, who lost more men fighting ISIS than America lost on D-Day, can claim to have the right answers. The bottom line is that America's involvement in Syria, inherited by Trump, has been fraught with confusion. All the major players in the conflict, including NATO, the Assad government, the Turks led by Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and Putin's Russia, have each contributed to the unfolding mess. It has led to untold deaths, torture, disappearances, and the use of chemical weapons. While the conflict began with a neocon-driven strategy to overthrow the Syrian government led by Bashar al-Assad, it morphed into one that was about confronting the terrifying menace of ISIS. Even with the focus shifting to ISIS, however, underlying tensions and strategic objectives always remained in play. While the U.S. and its allies, both Arab and European, fought ISIS with the military spearhead provided by the Kurds in Iraq and Syria, Turkey remained focused on what it planned to do when ISIS was defeated, namely removing any emerging Kurdish state developing across its border in Syria. Turkey was content to play a waiting game, but secretly it may have formed alliances with ISIS that Washington preferred to ignore and has continued to deny. According to a British intelligence source with links to NATO headquarters staff, who spoke to this writer on the condition of anonymity, Erdogan persuaded ISIS to attack Mosul in Iraq, an oil-rich center the Iraqi Kurds had hoped would guarantee them a rich future. In return, thousands of foreign ISIS fighters were permitted to transit through Turkey to fight in Iraq and Syria. They even used Turkey for rest, recuperation, and medical support. While Turkey plotted to deal with the Kurds, Assad, with Russian military assistance, effectively regained control of much of the lands he lost in the early years of the conflict. The sheer complexity of the Syrian conflict is such that it was never going to be solved by an American military presence. Does that justify Trump abandoning the Kurds? It does not, but it helps explain why he may have felt that he had no good answers, and whatever he did would have unfortunate consequences and ultimately be condemned by his friends and opponents alike. Just like all the major figures, including his predecessors, Presidents Bush and Obama, as well as Putin, Erdogan, and Assad, Trump will have to live with the consequences of his own policies, no matter how much he feels it is best for America, as it is now. According to reports, the Kurds have negotiated with Russia and the Syrians to secure some semblance of protection. Russian soldiers are now patrolling the border between Syria where the Kurds are and Turkey. The Kurds have also turned over a number of high-profile ISIS prisoners to the UK and to the US. Looming in the shadows is the threat of a resurgent ISIS, because the Kurds, who have been guarding thousands of ISIS fighters in Syria, now say the terrorists are no longer their priority as they deal with the threat from Turkey. Trump's somewhat crude response to the ISIS threat was that the ISIS terrorists will all head for Europe if they escape or are released. They may go to Europe, but they will always seek to target America, Americans, and American interests. Before abandoning the Kurds, there should have been plans in place to secure the ISIS fighters and 50,000 of their wives and children who are also in Kurdish detention facilities. The U.S. military can also feel aggrieved about the fact that it has been forced to abandon Kurdish forces it fought alongside and admired. There is no love lost between U.S. generals and Turkey. For example, in 2018, when Turkey first invaded the Kurdish enclave of Afrin in Syria, Erdogan warned the U.S. forces operating with the Kurds that they would get the Ottoman slap if they got in his way. The Ottoman slap is a term used by the Turks to indicate a single action that can pulverize an enemy. It was a boast by Erdogan that failed to take account of the fact that the U.S. never backs away from threats to its military personnel on the ground. It is something Erdogan would do well to remember while some U.S. special forces remain in Syria. Trump can end bogus war on terror. Talk of impeachment may inspire president to challenge warmongers. By Dr. Kevin Barrett on September 11, 2001. Donald Trump correctly stated that explosives must have been used to destroy the World Trade Center skyscrapers. Mere plane crashes, he observed, should not have been able to destroy the big, heavy I-beams. Since that dark day 18 years ago, Trump has kept his private skepticism about what brought down the Twin Towers to himself, but he has been candid, often outspoken, about the folly of the 9/11 wars. On October 9th of this year he tweeted, "The United States has spent $8 trillion fighting and policing in the Middle East. Thousands of our great soldiers have died or been badly wounded. Millions of people have died on the other side. Going into the Middle East is the worst decision ever made." That sounds like the real Trump. The one who has stopped caring what the neoliberal media, his own neocon advisors, and the Washington establishment in general think of him. It seems that the establishment's push to impeach Trump may have backfired. Instead of convincing Trump to toe the line and follow the path of least resistance, the impeachment inquiry seems to have stiffened the president's spine. The imperialists, both neoliberal and neoconservative, are outraged by Trump's decision to stop supporting Kurdish separatists in Syria. They are screaming that Trump has surrendered to Turkish President Recep Erdogan. Trump's relatively friendly personal relations with Erdogan, Russian President Vladimir Putin, North Korean Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un, Chinese President Xi Jinping, and others as presented by the neocon, neolib media is another form of collusion. The same people who oppose Trump's pullout from Syria are also complaining about the president's decision to withdraw from Afghanistan. In both cases, they say, the terrorists are coming to get us. If we don't fight them over there, the saying goes, we'll have to fight them over here. What insane rubbish. The only reason terrorists would even consider targeting America, as opposed to, say, Switzerland or Finland, is that the U.S., unlike Switzerland or Finland, is killing millions of people in their countries. If the U.S. stops killing people in the Middle East, then people in the Middle East will have no reason to want to kill Americans. Trump has been accused of hating and slandering Muslims, but in deploring the mass murder of millions by U.S. forces in the Middle East, Trump sounds far more sensitive and compassionate than the Democrats. What Democrat, other than Tulsi Gabbard, would ever tweet anything like millions of people have died on the other side? Going into the Middle East is the worst decision ever made? None of the Democrats seem to care about the 27 million people who have died on the other side as a result of the 9/11 wars. Avoidable mortality expert Dr. Gideon Polia writes, U.S. imposed deaths from violence or from war imposed deprivation are estimated to total 6 million. Iraqi genocide, 1990-2017, 6 million. Afghan genocide, 2001-2017, 2.2 million. Somali genocide, 1992-2017, 1 million, Syrian genocide, 2012-2017, and 0.2 million, Libyan genocide, 2011-2017, with refugees totaling 6 million, Iraq, 2 million, Afghan, Iceland, 1 million, Somalia, 12 million, Syria, and 1 million, Libya. Trump, unlike most Democrats and Republicans, sees this Holocaust for what it is, and is trying to end it. Trump's America First attitude terrifies the establishment. On January 19, 2018, Deep State denizens John Kelly, H.R. McMaster, Rex Tillerson, and James Mad Dog Mattis dragged Trump to a special National Security Council meeting in the Situation Room. They hammered away at Trump with a presentation on why America must police the world. According to Bob Woodward's book Fair, Trump was unconvinced, responding, "We have spent $7 trillion in the Middle East. We can't even muster $1 trillion for domestic infrastructure." The deep staters were horrified. Mattis compared Trump to a fifth or sixth grader. Tillerson called Trump a moron. Trump's ex-lawyer doubt piled on, telling Robert Mueller that Trump is an idiot, a goddamn dumbbell. But what is so stupid about wondering why the US needs to spend $7 trillion policing the Middle East for Israel? Is it only 5th and 6th graders who understand that murdering 27 million people for no apparent good reason is just plain wrong? Woodward's fear depicts a president who has been assiduously trying to extract America's military from its seemingly endless Middle Eastern quagmires, only to be stymied, browbeaten, and resisted at every turn by his advisors and the rest of official Washington. Woodward explains that Trump's aides have pulled off nothing less than an administrative coup d'état, an undermining of the will of the President of the United States and his constitutional authority. Will Trump, angered by impeachment efforts, choose to reclaim his constitutional authority and put a definitive end to the 9/11 wars? Bad idea to keep poking Russians. Tensions in Black Sea could rise dramatically if U.S. agitation doesn't stop. By Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. The neoconservatives who run U.S. foreign policy are now hurting the U.S. out of the remaining arms limitations agreements. It appears that Washington intends to withdraw from the Open Skies Agreement with Russia. The Open Skies Treaty allowed the U.S. and Russia to overfly each other's territory in order that there could be mutual assurance that one country or the other wasn't building up forces for attack. If Washington withdraws from the treaty, which seems in the cards, tensions and uncertainties between the two major nuclear powers will increase. In no way is this a good thing. The American military security complex wants the tensions to increase, because this makes the orchestrated Russia threat even larger and leads to a larger budget and more profits and power for the complex. The military security complex, about which President Eisenhower warned us, to no effect, has been highly successful in dismantling the arms control agreements made between past U.S. and Russian leaders. This has raised the profits of the U.S. military security complex at the expense of the security of the world. On top of this, Washington is currently raising tensions in the Black Sea, arming Ukraine, Georgia, and Romania, countries that border the Black Sea along with Russia, Turkey, and Bulgaria. The U.S. and its NATO puppets are conducting military exercises in this internal sea that hosts Russia's Crimean naval base. The Black Sea is Russia's exit to the Mediterranean Sea. The neocon warmongers would love to cut off Russia's access to the Mediterranean and, thereby, Russia's naval base in Syria. This would make it easier for the neoconservatives to overthrow Syria for Israel. This is irresponsible provocation on the part of Washington. A buildup of forces in such a small area carries all kinds of risks. It would be easy for a CIA black op to provoke one of the Ukrainian Nazis or one of the Georgian fools or one of the bought-and-paid-for Romanian vassals to provoke an incident. Indeed, the purpose of the U.S. buildup of forces is to provoke incidents that can be blamed on Russia in order to create more fear and loathing in the West in order to keep feeding the military security budget. Russia, a country in which the military security complex, to the extent that it exists, does not run the country, has difficulty comprehending what it is facing. Wanting no conflict, the Russian responses, as I have often emphasized, are passive and thus provoke more irresponsible moves by Washington. As there is no doubt that the buildup of U.S. and vassal state military forces in Russia's neighborhood is very dangerous and gives every opportunity to the CIA to create incidents that can be used for anti-Russian propaganda, as it is very easy for such incidents to have unintended consequences and to get out of control. Anything that can be done to stop the buildup of Western forces in the Black Sea and in Romania, Ukraine, and Georgia is an act of peace. Russia needs to understand that sometimes peace is protected by a more aggressive, instead of passive, response. What might such a response be? It seems to me that if the U.S. can declare the South China Sea, thousands of miles from the U.S. coastline, to be a U.S. national security interest, Russia can declare the Black Sea on Russia's own coast to be a Russian national security interest. It would be a highly responsible decision for the Russian government to prevent the dangers that Washington is creating by taking a lesson from ancient Rome. Rome declared a much larger sea, the Mediterranean Sea, to be Mare Nostrum, our sea. The Russians could declare the Black Sea to be our sea, as Russia is by far the most powerful force in the area. The U.S. is on the low end of the correlation of forces. No one could do anything about it if Russia were to declare the Black Sea Mare Nostrum. Russia could politely inform other parties that no military vessels of any other country are permitted in the Black Sea without Russian permission. This would exclude the US and its NATO, Ukrainian, Romanian, and Georgian vessels. Russia should specify an immediate date by which the foreign military vessels must leave the Black Sea or be escorted out by Russian forces, or, if resistance is met, destroyed. This would bring to an end the Zionist Shia attempt to create a new avenue to demonize Russia. It would protect Russia from multiple attacks all along its borders. U.S. using lawfare to silence the truth. Intelligence agencies have legal ways to keep whistleblowers, scapegoats quiet. By Philip Giraldi. The United States prides itself on its rule of law, a legacy from British colonial times, but there is increasing evidence that equal justice under law has been replaced by something that is sometimes called lawfare, an Israeli invention which consists of using the legal system to punish dissent and silence critics. Three examples, all quite different, illustrate exactly how a quasi-legal process has been used against individuals that are perceived to be, rightly or wrongly, critics of America's so-called global war on terror, which is still being conducted worldwide even though no one uses the expression anymore. The global war on terror is being fought based on legislation that is unique to the United States, which, under the various editions of the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, AUMF, authorizes the United States to go after any group anywhere that has been identified by the Department of State as terrorist. This authority has meant in practice that even American citizens can be killed or captured by U.S. special forces in any country, which of course includes nations with which the United States is not at war, not surprisingly, as Washington is not technically at war with anyone. The AUMF has also been interpreted to permit going after entire countries or political groups designated state sponsors of terrorism. Once presumed terrorists are captured, they can be held indefinitely in special prisons, Guantanamo being the one that is best known. That is precisely the case of Pakistani citizen Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, KSM, the alleged mastermind of 9/11, who was captured in March 2002 in Rawalpindi, Pakistan. But are the claims about his involvement really true? KSM has been tortured and eventually confessed to many crimes, but he has never been tried, even though rumors frequently surface in Washington that his day in court will be coming up soon. Recently, military judges asserted that he would finally be tried in January 2021 but warned that a number of conditions would have to be met first. That KSM has never appeared in court is generally believed to be because the actual evidence against him is so thin and was obtained under torture, so he has been held in prison under orders from Presidents Bush, Obama, and Trump with no end in sight, and without providing his testimony regarding events on the September day. One more piece of the 9/11 puzzle will never be revealed to the public. As the federal government is wedded to its standard account of 9/11, it is likely the KSM will remain in prison until the day he dies, setting an example for all those who choose to question the sanctity of the 9/11 Commission report. Julian Assange is another notable example of how revenge against those who question standard narratives is meted out through the legal system. Assange, to be sure, has been guilty of publishing material that the United States government would prefer not to have been made public. His website, WikiLeaks, was conceived as a whistleblower site, with information provided to it by individuals who had uncovered illegal activity on the part of various governments. WikiLeaks exposed, for example, Chelsea Manning's Iraq war crimes material and the Hillary Clinton and Democratic National Committee, DNC, emails. In Assange's defense, he has stated repeatedly that he is a journalist who exposes government wrongdoing, which used to be referred to as a muckraker. He never engaged in personally stealing government secrets and only published material that was given to him by others. In some cases, he refused to publish material that would hurt or endanger individuals. Assange became a target of US and British law enforcement in 2010. Living in London at the time, he was accused by several Swedish women of sexual assault, leading to a request from Stockholm for extradition. At the time, many believed that the accusations were without merit, and, indeed, they were eventually dropped. But Assange was about to be arrested by the British authorities after he failed to make a bail hearing set to contest the Swedish extradition request. To avoid arrest, he fled to the Ecuadorian embassy in 2012 and was granted asylum, where he eventually spent 7 years, eventually confined to a small room. His health suffered, forced to leave by the Ecuadorian withdrawal of his asylum under U.S. pressure. He was arrested in 2019 by the British and is currently in prison, where his health continues to deteriorate. He will eventually be sent to the United States upon release in early 2020, where he will undoubtedly be convicted under the Espionage Act of 1918, a rarely invoked law that can be brought out whenever the federal government is desperate to convict someone. It was recently used in May 2015 to imprison ex-CIA officer Jeffrey Sterling, even though there was no evidence that he had actually revealed classified information. The prosecution claimed that he must have done it, which was apparently enough for the judge and jury. There is also a backstory to Assange. He has always insisted that the information he received on the DNC emails did not come from a Russian source. One of the basic claims made that launched the years-long investigation of what became known as RussiaGate. Many suspect that a DNC staffer named Seth Rich might have been the actual source, but the government and the Democratic Party have resisted any serious investigation into that possibility. If Assange is ever actually tried, he might reveal the truth, but one must consider that folks who have secrets damaging to the government are either somehow silenced or even wind up dead. So Assange, who only did what a good journalist is supposed to do, will, like KSM, likely die in prison after the U.S. gets its hands on him. And finally, there is the case of Edward Snowden, a government contractor who discovered that the NSA was spying illegally on literally millions of Americans. He went through channels to complain about what was being done, was ignored, and eventually sent his information over to several journalists, who published his claims. Snowden knew that even though he was a whistleblower and was allegedly protected by special whistleblower legislation, there was no chance that he would ever receive a fair trial in the U.S., so he fled first to China and then wound up in Russia, where he is today. He has stated that he would return to the United States to tell his story if he is guaranteed a fair trial that will enable him to use a public interest whistleblower defense, but no one is taking the bait. Many in Congress and even some in the media have called for his execution as a traitor. Some of us, however, regard him as a hero. Truly, the land of the free and the home of the brave has become something like a prison camp for those who fall outside the limits of acceptable behavior as defined by the government. Law is the weapon, and it is wielded equally by Democrats and Republicans. Do KSM, Assange, and Snowden all have interesting tales to tell? Indeed, they do. But we the public will likely never hear them. Unemployment stats are fake news. Job numbers from Bureau of Labor Statistics formally can't be trusted. By Donald Jeffries in 1994, the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, BLS, dramatically altered the way the most common reported unemployment figures, known as U3, are calculated. From that moment forward, only those presently collecting unemployment benefits were considered unemployed in publicly released figures. The long-term unemployed, those without a job for more than 52 weeks, are simply dropped from the official labor force, even if they are actively seeking work. The average duration of unemployment is at least 40 weeks, making a mockery of this deceptive change. The definition of employment was changed as well, so that if someone even babysat a few times during the past 30 days, they are officially considered employed. The U3 index, which garners the headlines, doesn't even attempt to factor in part-time workers. The revised, deceptive unemployment numbers also don't consider the millions of disabled Americans, most of whom would certainly be unemployed without Social Security, disability insurance, and other programs. The electronic newsletter Shadow Government Statistics provides a much more accurate picture of the bleak American job market. They factor in long-term discouraged workers, who were defined out of existence in 1994. They utilize the Bureau of Labor's broadest unemployment measure, U6, which also includes those forced into part-time work because they can't find full-time jobs. As of September 2019, The far more accurate U6 figures show that America's unemployment rate is actually 20.9%. Candidate Donald Trump was the first political figure to rightfully call out these fake unemployment numbers. "Don't believe these phony numbers," Trump declared in early 2016. "The number is probably 28, 29, as high as 35%. In fact, I even heard recently 42%. During his confirmation hearing, Trump's Secretary of the Treasury Steve Mnuchin echoed these sentiments, saying, "The unemployment rate is not real. I've traveled for the last year. I've seen this." Upon attaining the presidency, Trump's tune changed dramatically on this issue. Trump's first press secretary, Sean Spicer, explained, "I talked to the president prior to this and he said, to quote him very clearly, 'They may have been phony in the past, but it's very real now.'" To a chorus of laughter from the Washington press corps, candidate Trump may have called the official job numbers total fiction and one of the biggest hoaxes in American modern politics, but he now boasts about those same numbers. The deceptive calculation of unemployment figures hasn't changed since Trump was elected. In recent months, the laughable claim has been made that the economy is booming to such an extent that there are now more available jobs than job seekers. This, of course, plays into the long-time corporate refrain that they are forced to seek cheap labor, through visa workers or simply undocumented workers, because otherwise they can't fill their vacant positions. A year ago, Trump bragged, "Job openings exceed the number of unemployed people in our country for the first time in recorded history." Remember, unemployed doesn't include anyone who isn't presently filing for unemployment benefits. By all accounts, there are currently at least 93 million adult Americans who aren't working, even factoring out retired people, college students not working, and the dwindling number of spouses staying at home by choice. This glaring fact makes such grandiose claims mathematically impossible. 1 in 5 American households have no one in them working and effectively have zero or negative wealth. Presumably, these employment-free households would be keenly interested in this supposed plethora of jobs. An analysis by news website Axios of jobs created since the economic crisis of 2008 found that some 75% pay less than what is considered the bottom level of a middle-class income, which is $45,000 minus $50,000 annually. With the outsourcing of industry, professions once considered the backbone of the American economy, which largely produced the large, thriving middle class that made this country the envy of the world, have largely vanished. When the party in power, Democrat or Republican, boasts about the tremendous job growth, in reality they are referring to minimum wage and slightly above positions, or part-time work, none of which afford those working them to even live independently. The impact of immigration, both illegal and through insidious foreign visa worker programs, as well as increasing automation, have contributed mightily to a lowering of blue-collar wages. Some sources even lower the standard for middle-wage jobs to a paltry $14.26 an hour, which again will not allow an employee to rent a one-bedroom apartment, let alone pursue the great American dream of home ownership. With college students holding an average of $32,000 in student loan debt, companies have simply begun requiring degrees for lower-paying positions that used to go to high school graduates. Statistics are always manipulated for political purposes, regardless of which political party is in the White House. U.S. Bill of Rights turns 230 government routinely ignores key tenets of historic rights document. By John W. Whitehead. It's been 230 years since James Madison drafted the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, as a means of protecting the people against government tyranny. And what do we have to show for it? Nothing good. In America today, the government does whatever it wants. Freedom be damned. We can pretend that the Constitution, which was written to hold the government accountable, is still our governing document. But the reality of life in the American police state tells a different story. We the people have been terrorized, traumatized, and tricked into a semi-permanent state of compliance by a government that cares nothing for our lives or our liberties. The boogeyman's names and faces have changed over time, but the end result remains the same. In the so-called name of national security, the Constitution has been steadily chipped away, undermined, eroded, whittled down, and generally discarded to such an extent that what we are left with today is but a shadow of the robust document adopted more than two centuries ago. Most of the damage has been inflicted upon the Bill of Rights. A recitation of the Bill of Rights, set against a backdrop of government surveillance, militarized police, SWAT team raids, asset forfeiture, eminent domain, over-criminalization, armed surveillance drones, whole-body scanners, stop-and-frisk searches, all sanctioned by Congress, the White House, the courts, and the like, would sound more like a eulogy to freedoms lost than an affirmation of rights we truly possess. Here is what it means to live under the Constitution today. The First Amendment is supposed to protect the freedom to speak your mind, assemble, and protest nonviolently without being bridled by the government. It also protects the freedom of the media, as well as the right to worship and pray without interference. In other words, Americans should not be silenced by the government. To the founders, all of America was a free speech zone. Despite the clear protections found in the First Amendment, the freedoms described there, in are under constant assault. The Second Amendment was intended to guarantee the right of the people to keep and bear arms. This amendment was intended to give the citizenry the means to resist tyrannical government. Yet while gun ownership has been recognized by the Supreme Court as an individual citizen right, Americans remain powerless to defend themselves against SWAT team raids and government agents armed to the teeth with military weapons better suited for the battlefield. The Third Amendment reinforces the principle that civilian, elected officials are superior to the military by prohibiting the military from entering any citizen's home without the consent of the owner, with the police increasingly training like the military, acting like the military, and posing as military forces. Complete with heavily armed SWAT teams, military weapons, and assault vehicles, it is clear that we now have what the founders feared most, a standing army on American soil. The Fourth Amendment prohibits government agents from conducting surveillance on you or touching you or invading you, unless they have some evidence that you're up to something criminal. In other words, the Fourth Amendment ensures privacy and bodily integrity. Unfortunately, the Fourth Amendment has suffered the greatest damage in recent years and has been all but eviscerated by an unwarranted expansion of police powers that include strip searches and even anal and vaginal searches of citizens, surveillance, corporate and otherwise, and intrusions justified in the name of fighting terrorism, as well as the outsourcing of otherwise illegal activities to private contractors. The Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment work in tandem. These amendments supposedly ensure that you are innocent until proven guilty, and government authorities cannot deprive you of your life, your liberty, or your property without the right to an attorney and a fair trial before a civilian judge. However, in the new suspect society in which we live, where surveillance is the norm, these fundamental principles have been upended. Certainly, if the government can arbitrarily freeze, seize, or lay claim to your property, money, land, or possessions, under government asset forfeiture schemes, you have no true rights. The Seventh Amendment guarantees citizens the right to a jury trial, yet when the populace has no idea of what's in the Constitution, civic education has virtually disappeared from most school curriculums. That inevitably translates to an ignorant jury incapable of distinguishing justice and the law from their own preconceived notions and fears. The Eighth Amendment is similar to the Sixth in that it is supposed to protect the rights of the accused and forbid the use of cruel and unusual punishment. However, the Supreme Court's determination that what constitutes cruel and unusual should be dependent on the evolving standards of decency that marked the progress of a maturing society leaves us with little protection in the face of a society lacking in morals altogether. The Ninth Amendment provides that other rights not enumerated in the Constitution are nonetheless retained by the people. Popular sovereignty, the belief that the power to govern flows upward from the people rather than downward from the rulers, is clearly evident in this amendment. However, it has since been turned on its head by a centralized federal government that sees itself as supreme and which continues to pass more and more laws that restrict our freedoms under the pretext that it has an important government interest in doing so. The Tenth Amendment's reminder that the people and the states retain every authority that is not otherwise mentioned in the Constitution, That assurance of a system of government in which power is divided among local, state, and national entities, has long since been rendered moot by the centralized Washington, D.C. power elite, the President, Congress, and the courts. If there is any sense to be made from this recitation of freedoms lost, it is simply this: our individual freedoms have been eviscerated so that the government's powers could be expanded dramatically. Yet those who gave us the Constitution and the Bill of Rights believe that the government exists at the behest of its citizens. It is there to protect, defend, and enhance our freedoms, not violate them. It was no idle happenstance that the Constitution opens with these three powerful words: "We the people, we the citizenry are the arbiters and ultimate guardians of America's welfare, defense, liberty, laws, and prosperity." 500 scientists, no climate catastrophe, decades of schizophrenic warnings about global warming, ice ages are bogus, by Dave Gahiri, with non-stop coverage of the latest doomsday oil and the powers who should not be have strutted out on the stage. It's easy to forget just how many times dire warnings have been issued about how the Earth's climate was on the verge of wiping out all life on the planet. For those of you fed up with the grating gyrations of Greta Thunberg, the troubled teenager being used by climate change chicken little leftists like George Soros and Bill Gates, here are some nasty little facts the state-run media would love to keep under wraps. 1939, a few months after The Wizard of Oz had its theatrical premiere in Green Bay, Wisconsin. 1939, a newspaper headline appeared as follows: "Greenland's glaciers melting, says scientist. All the glaciers in eastern Greenland are rapidly melting," declared Professor Hans Almen, Swedish geologist, the article screamed. It may without exaggeration be said that the glaciers, like those in Norway, face the possibility of a catastrophic collapse. Almen crowed, "They just love that word catastrophe, don't they?" 1947, 7.5 years later, Almen, feted and touted by those much smarter than us, was at it again, issuing his dire warnings: "The possibility of a prodigious rise in the surface of the ocean with resultant widespread inundation, arising from an Arctic climate phenomenon, was discussed yesterday by Dr. Hans Almen, a noted Swedish geophysicist at the University of California Geophysical Institute. A mysterious warming of the climate was slowly manifesting itself in the Arctic," stated Almen, who warned that oceanic surfaces would rise to catastrophic proportions and people living in the Greenland lowlands would be inundated. "It's no mystery, Hans. It's nature." 1952, polar ice thaw increasing, glaciers said to be melting, said the headline. This time, Arctic expert Dr. William S. Carlson said that the polar ice caps were melting at an astonishing and unexplained rate and were threatening to swamp seaports by raising the ocean levels. "We're still waiting, Bill." 1955, Arctic explorer A.D.M. Donald Macmillan was next to warn, stating, "There are now 6 million square miles of ice in the Arctic. There once were 12 million square miles." Perhaps realizing their dire predictions were not panning out, the experts were no longer warning of global warming, but had switched to global cooling and a coming ice age. "You can't make this stuff up." 1970, the next expert trotted out was James P. Lodge, Jr., a scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. In an article titled "Scientist Predicts a New Ice Age by 21st Century," Lodge warned that air pollution may obliterate the sun and cause a new ice age in the first third of the new century. Jim, can you pass me those sunglasses?" 1972, things were so dire in the 1970s that two of the nation's top geologists found it necessary to alert President Richard Nixon of the impending doom: a global deterioration of climate, by order of magnitude larger than any hitherto experienced by civilized mankind, is a very real possibility and indeed may be to very soon. The present rate of cooling, they warned, seems fast enough to bring glacial temperatures in about a century, if continuing at the present pace. 1975, by now, most of the fake news media was on the bandwagon, running story after story on predictions of the coming ice age. 1978, an international team of specialists has concluded from 8 indexes of climate that there's no end in sight to the cooling trend of the last 30 years, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, squawked the nation's newspaper of record. 1979. The following year, the Grey Lady reversed course, predicting an Arctic meltdown, blaming global warming caused by carbon dioxide emissions. There is a real possibility that some people now in their infancy will live to a time when the ice at the North Pole will have melted, a change that would cause swift and perhaps catastrophic changes in climate. There's that word catastrophic again. 1981. Not yet sink to spew identical nonsense, the Chicago Tribune still thought global cooling was the way to go, and reported some more unfounded, dire warnings about a freezing planet. Toward the end of the 1980s, however, the global warming playbook was adopted by all in the fake news media, who have been constantly predicting polar ice cap melting on a catastrophic scale. And of course, our good friends in the fake news media would never put the billow in their fine papers or networks. 2019. In a September 24th, Breitbart News Network headline, 500 scientists write UN, there is no climate emergency. The only news platform with some heft reported on the letter sent from the oft-overlooked scientists and professionals in climate and related fields to the United Nations, asking for a long-overdue, high-level, open debate on climate change. The two-page letter should have been splattered across the pages and screens of all the major media. But here's why it wasn't. As revealed by its main points, there is no climate emergency. Warming is far slower than predicted. Climate policy relies on inadequate models. CO2 is plant food, the basis of all life on Earth. Global warming has not increased natural disasters. Policy must respect scientific and economic realities. Natural as well as anthropogenic factors cause warming of the Earth. A wise man once said, if you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it. Another wise man once said, freedom of the press is guaranteed only to those who own one. Thank God there are honest alternative media outlets like American Free Press still publishing the truth about contentious topics. Bilderberger's Brexit Confessions, by Mark Anderson, Chicago, IL. The appearance of Zanny Minton-Bedos, editor-in-chief of The Economist, at a luncheon of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, CCGA, on October 4th, was handled carefully. Besides the fact that the Windy City's big box media greeted her timely remarks about Brexit with silence, the highly influential CCGA was careful to introduce her as the head of a stridently internationalist publication. There was nary a word, however, about her membership on the Bilderberg steering committee and her steady attendance at the annual Bilderberg meetings as part of a media coterie that attends the hyper exclusive gatherings bit papers over the existence of such meetings and masks their agenda. Minton-Bedos addressed Brexit rather cryptically, giving an insider's look at the British exit from the European Union that could happen October 31st. As she discussed Brexit with CCGA Vice President of Studies Brian Hansen, she adopted a fragile pretense of neutrality that held for much of the luncheon, but that pretense discernibly unraveled as she explored Brexit's complexities while responding to a key question from this writer, bringing up a hush-hush matter that the anti-Brexit establishment steadfastly avoids. This writer asked her about the growing UK-EU military union, which hardwires the UK into the EU in a prolonged fashion, and inquired whether that union could result in a Brexit that's only an exit on paper, but which cannot be fully consummated. This writer also asked whether it's possible to extricate Britain from the EU when much of the EU's complex body of rules and regulations has been integrated into the British legal code. The British-born editor's reply to the two-part question quickly snowballed and became convoluted, likely because the Bilderberg-aligned Economist, like most of the Western press, is so overwhelmingly opposed to Brexit. Despite her noted attempt at objectivity, that establishment editors get a bit off balance when asked unusual questions. Accordingly, Minton-Bedos tended to overstate the matter. Both sides will see it within their interest to maintain as close links as possible, she claimed, but the EU is a rules-based organization, and all of these links have been built up on the basis of the UK being a member state of the EU, as a result of which certain legal obligations and rights come. If we're no longer a member, then that is ended, she added, and so, we have to kind of rebuild those links, and that will take an enormous amount of time. And how easily it's done depends on whether there's willingness to negotiate that, willingness on both sides, and that, in turn, I think, depends on the terms of our departure. So, if we have a negotiated withdrawal, where this is done over many years and there's a transition period, with all the things that were in the withdrawal agreement that former PM Theresa May negotiated, and could be if there's an agreement with Boris Johnson now, then this stuff becomes the work of many bureaucratic hours. Notably, her words "when this is done over many years" were perhaps a slip that suggests that the fix may be in regarding the suspected elite tactic to drag out Brexit so long that another referendum could happen in order to negate the June 2016 Brexit referendum in which voters opted to leave the EU 52% to 48%. She went on to address this writer, "You're right, in many areas, we will want to maintain those links and the Europeans will also want to maintain those links, but that will have to be rebuilt." In response to a basic question from Hansen, "Why is Brexit so hard?" Minton Beddoes replied, "Thanks to the creation of the European single market, which the British championed and were the great driver for creating, British manufacturing is incredibly integrated with the EU." She also cited the enlargement of the EU, which The Economist champions, as another factor, along with heavy immigration. "We've had a huge number of people come to the UK from other countries. Brexit is like having a divorce after several decades of marriage. Another thing that complicates Brexit is that parliamentary sovereignty, where elected members of parliament make the decisions, was outsourced to the people in the form of direct democracy via the Brexit referendum," she said, with a hint of disregard for the legitimacy of the 2016 Brexit vote. "This happened," she continued, "because an element within the Tory Conservative Party has never been cozy with Britain being in the EU, and former Prime Minister David Cameron had to placate that element for political purposes. That, in turn, opened the door for a very large, disgruntled group of Britons to exercise a protest vote," Minton Beddoes also stated, once again jabbing the pro-Brexit electorate's vote as one of mere anger that lacks substance and solutions, a common flawed refrain from Bilderberg and ideologically connected think tanks like the CCGA when discussing anti-globalist populist movements. Minton Beddoes then effectively revealed her Bilderberg hand by floating the distinct possibility of a second referendum, while reiterating that the actual UK exit from the EU is supposed to happen October 31. She said the British Parliament is stipulating that if there's no written agreement in place to guide the Brexit process by around October 19, then an extension beyond October 31 will be required. That, she said, could lead to Parliament issuing a vote of no confidence in new Prime Minister Boris Johnson and force a second referendum that could overturn Brexit, impeach Kavanaugh, by St. Patrick in a blatantly partisan move that would continue to set precedents in the midst of our national political superstorm. Democrats have been very outspoken about the desire to impeach Justice Brett Kavanaugh from the bench of the Supreme Court. Kavanaugh has served on the Supreme Court for 1 year. The path to the bench was a difficult one for President Donald Trump's second Supreme Court appointee, Christine Blasey Ford, a psychology professor at Palo Alto University, accused Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her in high school. After the public dissection of both Kavanaugh's and Ford's lives concluded, Kavanaugh was confirmed in the Senate by a vote of 50-48, or 51.02%, the closest confirmation vote of any Supreme Court appointee in American history. Attorneys tied to Democratic causes levied 83 ethics complaints against the new justice, all stemming from his nomination hearings. The complaints were dismissed by a Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals judge in December, and in March the same Tenth Circuit Court rejected another 20 appeals to reinstate the original 83 complaints. Democratic activists keep on plugging. In truth, the lower courts have no authority to sanction a Supreme Court justice in any way. For the Supreme Court, a powerful part of its checks and balances is that it has no official code of conduct. Dissenting parties cannot attack a Supreme Court justice endlessly in court for supposed violations that, in truth, all emanate from a desire to see someone such as Kavanaugh or Clarence Thomas removed from the bench. At this point, Political attacks on Supreme Court justices can only be words in the influencing of public opinion. The predators have no bite, not legally. In a confounding recent situation, it has been leaked that New York Times reporters, publishing a book on Kavanaugh, have unearthed another allegation of inappropriate behavior, this time against a woman while Kavanaugh attended Yale University. There is a man who said he witnessed the inappropriate behavior, but he has declined to speak about it. The woman about whom the charge is based has also declined several interviews. Incredibly, her friends have told reporters that she doesn't even recall the incident. Therefore, the allegation is completely uncorroborated hearsay. Kamala Harris, Julian Castro, and Elizabeth Warren have all called for Kavanaugh's impeachment. A Supreme Court justice can indeed be impeached, as they, too, fall within the designation of the All Civil Officers of the United States Impeachment Guidelines in Article II, Section IV of the U.S. Constitution. They can be impeached for committing treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors, but if the charges levied against Kavanaugh are true, and they have been repeatedly debunked, with the lascivious behavior of an immature, drunken, college-aged partygoer be a high crime and misdemeanor? Also, would an act that occurred over 30 years ago hold the same legal weight as grounds for impeachment? Article II, Section I states that civil officers of the U.S. must hold their positions in good behavior. Kavanaugh has done just that. None of the 83 ethics complaints describe an action that took place after he was sworn in as a Supreme Court justice. He has served in good behavior. The impeachment of a justice would work as it does for a president. The House of Representatives would have to vote to impeach and then the Senate would have to vote to convict. Presidents Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton were impeached. Both lost the vote in the House, yet both retained their positions when the Senate did not vote to convict. Federal judges have been impeached and convicted, but none have come from the Supreme Court. There has been a minor backlash from longtime Democrats in the Senate, squelching the exuberance of far-left Democrats, while leftist Democrats like Ayanna Pressley, DeMass, continue to demand justice for survivors. Veteran Senate Minority Whip Dick Durbin, Deal, urged his colleagues to get real. "We've got to get beyond this. Impeachment is the answer to every problem. It's not realistic," Durbin pleaded. "If that's how we are identified in Congress, as the impeachment Congress, we run the risk that people will feel we're ignoring the issues that mean a lot to them as families. We now live in the antithesis of the kinder, gentler nations so hoped for at the twilight of the Reagan decade. These are different times, new times, even dangerous times. But of one thing we can be certain, actions teach acceptable behavior." The GOP has a mental, if not a literal, list of Democratic Party demands, strategies, and comments that have escalated the public discourse and democratic processes since the election of Trump in 2016. If Democrats have pushed the envelope in all three areas, Republicans have relearned what should now be acceptable behavior by a minority party. "We do reap what we sow, but what grows from that may, for working class Americans, be a political system gone rotten." Is U.S. border crisis under control? Numbers say Trump's tougher border security measures are finally working. By John Friend, the crisis along the porous southern border between the United States and Mexico may be finally under control, at least for now, as the U.S. enters the fall holiday season. Immigration officials responsible for policing the border and enforcing U.S. immigration law have apprehended close to 1 million illegal or inadmissible immigrants attempting to enter this country over the course of fiscal year 2019. Mark Morgan, the acting Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, CBP, recently announced, "This is the highest number apprehended since 2007. These numbers are numbers that no immigration system in the world is designed to handle, including ours," Morgan stated at a recent White House press briefing. "For much of this year, many thousands of migrants, often with fraudulent family claims and documentation, have attempted to enter the United States, often illegally. Promises of lucrative job offers and easy access to generous and easy-to-access social services, housing assistance, and welfare benefits have driven the migrant invasion, which has been fueled and facilitated by radical left-wing Open Borders activist organizations. So-called migrant caravans, often originating in Central American countries such as Guatemala or Honduras, have made their way north in an effort to secure entry to the U.S. As Morgan indicated, close to 1 million have been apprehended, yet many were able to gain entry to this country over the course of the past year as Border Patrol and immigration officials have been overwhelmed by the sheer numbers. In May, roughly 144,000 migrants either attempted to cross the border illegally or presented themselves at ports of entry without proper legal documentation, marking a high point this year. Since then, apprehensions have been slowly declining each month, with September marking the lowest number of the year with roughly 52,000, according to Morgan. Just 4 short months ago, our daily apprehensions were close to 5,000, and today it's below 1,700, Morgan stated. We went from over 19,000 people in custody, just 4 short months ago, to less than 4,000. Morgan credits the decrease in illegal entry attempts to changes in U.S. policy, including ending the absurd catch-and-release policy, which allowed migrants to be cited by unregistered with immigration officials only to then be released into the nation's interior with no way of ensuring the individual would show up at a future court hearing. We have essentially ended catch-and-release, Morgan explained. If you come to our borders now with a child, it's no longer an immediate passport into the interior of the United States. Instead, they will be afforded a lawful and expedited process, but they will not be released into the interior of the United States never to be heard from again. Family arrivals during 2019 tripled compared to previous years, with many families claiming asylum and attempting to enter the country with fraudulent family claims. The system was simply being abused and agents were overwhelmed, Morgan noted. Not so anymore. Our Border Patrol facilities were not designed to hold families or children. They were designed as policed stations, Morgan stated. The hundreds of thousands of families and children were told, coached, and made to believe if you make it to the United States border with a child, it was your passport into the interior U.S. The Mexican government has played a key role in helping get the crisis under control, according to Morgan. Rather than releasing migrants into the U.S. to await immigration court hearings, they are being forced to wait in Mexico for their court date, known as the Migrant Protection Protocol, MPP. Morgan credits this new policy with dramatically reducing the number of illegal aliens attempting to enter the U.S., often under dubious and fraudulent circumstances. MPP allowed for migrants illegally crossing, or at the ports of entry, without documents, to be returned to Mexico to await expedited immigration proceedings in the United States, Morgan explained. If they have meritorious claims, they receive relief in just a few months, rather than waiting in limbo in the United States, sometimes for years, and if they have unsuccessful claims, they are swiftly returned to their home country, or they can return voluntarily, Morgan continued. We're now sending the message that, if you're coming here as an economic migrant, you're not going to be allowed into the United States. That's driving a lot of people to return. As the 2020 election approaches, the immigration crisis continues to be one of the most pressing issues facing our nation. Firebrand, conservative author and political commentator Ann Coulter, a fierce critic of open borders and massive immigration into this country, recently argued that America is about to be over if we don't stop immigration, absolute stop. She powerfully stated on a recent radio interview, deport illegals, build a wall, go after refugee frauds, otherwise all our congressmen are going to be Ilhan Omar, referring to the far-left Democratic congresswoman representing Minnesota. Will the political establishment have the backbone to address the immigration crisis in the coming years? President Donald Trump, to his credit, has attempted to tackle the extremely contentious issue but has largely been stymied by Congress, the courts, and the media establishment, all of which are on board with the globalist open borders New World Order agenda.